Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's October the 22nd. We are in Parshas Kedoshim, beginning Shlishi on page 662. We're up to Pasuk Chaf Gimel 23. When you come to the land, unitatem kol eitz ma'achol, and you will plant any fruit tree, a tree that you can eat, va'araltem arloso es piryo. You will make its fruits off limits. You'll, how do they translate it here? You'll forbid the fruits.
They'll be forbidden to you.
Yeah. Shalosh shanim yalachem arelim. For 3 years, they'll be forbidden. Lo ye'achel. They shall not be eaten. Uvashana harevius, and in the fourth year, ye kol piryo kodesh hilulim Hashem, all of its fruits will be sanctified, and well, they say laud Hashem, praise Hashem. Uvashana achamishis, and in the fifth year, tochlu es piryo, you shall eat its fruits, vahusif lachem tivuaso, to add to you its produce. It probably says bounty here. Crop for you, yeah. Ani Hashem Elokecha, Mayim Hashem your God. Okay, so there's something about the third year, the fourth year, and the fifth year that are mentioned over here. Now, first of all, this term arla, which is how we refer to fruits in the first 3 years when a tree is grown, that term arla is the same root as arel. Arel means someone who is uncircumcised. And a male is uncircumcised, he's called an arel. This is the same word. We find the term arel used with people. We find it here with fruit. We have a term in the Chumash later on, va'aral tem es arlas levavchem, that one's heart can be arel. It means, as Rashi explains, something is covering it up. Something is getting in the way. That's what the term means. Here, there's no physical thing getting in the way, but the fruits are, you are to treat them like they are covered up. You are to treat them like they are off limits. There's that barrier between you and the fruits in the first 3 years of their growth. This mitzvah applies both in Israel and out of Israel. It applies in America, applies out in Chutz La'aretz as well. So what exactly is this mitzvah? So when you plant a fruit tree, the first 3 years of its growth, those fruits are prohibited. They are prohibited forever. They don't become permitted after the third year. Anything that grows in the first 3 years remains prohibited forever. The fruits that grow in the fourth year, as it says here, are sanctified as to laud Hashem, to praise Hashem, which Chazal, our sages explain, means they have the same rule as Maaser Sheni. What's the rule of Maaser Sheni, the second tithe? The rule is that those fruits may not be eaten outside of Yerushalayim. They can be eaten, but only in Yerushalayim. If the fruits are going to spoil by the time you get to Yerushalayim, either because you're not going right now or because they're too much to carry, then you can exchange the fruits for money, eat the fruits wherever you wish, take the money to Yerushalayim the next time you go to Yerushalayim, spend the money on food in Yerushalayim and eat that food in Yerushalayim. And that is the process, that is what is called neta revoi, which is the plants of the fourth year. Yes?
What if you plant a tree, but it takes 2 years until...
Yes, we're going to get to that. We're going to talk about... Okay. Yeah. Good question.
If this applies outside of Israel, so we would give tzedakah?
No, not give tzedakah. You take a coin and you exchange the fruits for the coin so that the sanctity of the fruits goes onto the coin.
But I'm here, I'm not there.
That's okay. That's
so
right.
Next time you go, you take that coin.
You take that coin with you to Eretz Yisrael. Next time you're in Yerushalayim, you purchase food and you eat it over there.
Okay. We're
talking about when there's a Beis HaMikdash. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, that's okay. I remember that.
No, okay.
No, I was going to say, what would you pick the fruit off from the first 2 years so that you know which is the third year?
Yeah. The first three, it's all 3 years. The first 3 years are off limits. You got to throw them out, throw them away. You can't use them. You can't get benefit from them. You can't give them to your animals. You can't sell them to a non-Jew. They are off limits. You have to discard them.
Fertilizer.
Can't use them for fertilizer either.
But if they fall to the ground, they...
All right, they sit there. Now, so this rule of the fourth year of Netat Revoi, of the fruits that grow in a fourth year, as I said, they have, it's the same rule with Maaser Sheni. If you grow in Eretz Yisrael, if you're in Israel and you grow, let's say, wheat, so we know that you take the very first wheat that ripens is Bikurim. That's the first fruits that are taken to Yerushalayim and given to the Kohen. Then there is Truma. Truma is approximately 2% of whatever is grown, and that's also given to the Kohen. Then there is Maaser Rishon, the first tithe, which is 10%. That is given to the Levi. And then, depending on what year it is in the Shemitah cycle, but there is typically Maaser Sheni, also a second 10%, a second tithe. That Maaser Sheni has the same rule. That Maaser Sheni, that grain, that produce, has to be eaten in Yerushalayim. You either take that produce to Yerushalayim, or you exchange that produce for money, eat the produce wherever you wish. That money is taken to Yerushalayim, usually for Pesach, Shavuos, or Sukkot, which is when you're going anyway. And when you get to Yerushalayim, you spend the money on food in Yerushalayim and eat the food there. That's what is typically done with Maaser Sheni, and the same rule applies to Netat Revoi. However, Maaser Sheni only applies in Eretz Yisrael. Grain grown outside of Eretz Yisrael is not required to have Trumos or Maasros separated from it. But Netat Revoi, the fruits of the fourth year, apply everywhere, even outside of Eretz Yisrael.
So if there's no Beis HaMikdash, we can eat the first 3 years now?
No, the first 3 years are prohibited.
They're still prohibited.
They're still prohibited, and the fourth year has to be exchanged for money. Same rules apply. The difference is only this, that today, those who go to Israel have to take off their own tithes, know that this is the case. Today, since we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, Yerushalayim is not functioning the way that it's supposed to be functioning, you can't take the money and bring it to Yerushalayim and exchange it for food and eat it in Yerushalayim. Instead, what you do is you exchange the fruit for money, and then that money is discarded. That money is destroyed. It's thrown into the ocean. It's discarded, gotten rid of, and the money is not used. Now you can use a small coin, a relatively inexpensive coin, for a lot of produce, and you can do. But at a certain point, that coin has to be thrown away. And it can't be used for anything. That's what typically happens today in Eretz Yisrael with tithing of the Maaser Sheni, the second tithe. And the same would apply for the fourth year fruits the fourth year of Netat Revoi. Yeah.
So some trees don't fruit for the first few years.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So it's not most trees don't.
Right.
So that is really why it's less of an issue. The reason why it's not such a big issue is because most trees, if you plant them from a seed, will not produce fruit in the first number of years, usually well more than 4 years. It takes a while for a tree to grow to a point where it will produce fruit. So if the tree is in its fifth, sixth, or seventh year and it starts to give off fruit, that's fine. The prohibition is not the first year that the tree produces fruit. It's the first 3 years that the tree is grown. Now, what becomes complicated is this. If you have a tree that is a grown tree and it is producing fruit, then you uproot that tree and replant it, is that considered a new planting of the tree, in which case you'd have to prohibit the next 3 years of the fruits, or is it considered to be the same adult tree? It just moves on in its years and it does not restart the clock. So that depends on the following factor. If the tree is uprooted and replanted, if there's enough soil uprooted with the tree, usually when you uproot a tree, if your intention is to replant it, they remove it with all of its roots or many of its roots along with a whole bunch of soil. It comes out together. So if there's enough soil that the tree could live off of that soil for a period of time, it won't die, then when you put it back in the ground in a new location, it is not considered like you're planting the tree for the first time. The clock does not restart, and you're fine. You don't have to prohibit the fruits. But if when the tree is uprooted, there is not enough soil there for the tree to live, and then it is replanted immediately, that would be considered like a brand new planting of the tree, and the first 3 years of the fruits would be prohibited. The reason why this is relevant is because if you take a branch of the tree, you cut off a branch of the tree, a healthy branch of the tree, and stick that branch in the ground, well, that branch comes with no soil. That's like a brand new planting of a tree. And the next 3 years worth of fruits would be prohibited. This happens when people have saplings and they, I've seen posted here for the community of people who have had saplings of various types of whatever it is, peach trees or whatever types of trees there are, and offered community members to come and they'll take their sapling and you can take it to your lawn and plant it in your lawn. Well, if you do that, that's already a tree that's closer to producing fruit. So it depends whether soil is removed with the sapling or not. If enough soil is removed with the sapling that the sapling will live, that's fine. But if not, then you have to count the years of Arla, of the prohibited fruits, starting from when you put it back in the ground. It also, we'll leave that. There's another discussion, but that's not for this. So that's why it can be relevant even today. Yeah?
So Rabbi Pansky, my friend had a beautiful fig tree. So there was a very low branch. So we put a piece of concrete on that low branch, and it touched the ground, and it rooted. So we took up some soil with that and cut off the branch after it rooted and then brought it to my yard. Now, I don't know if there's enough. I mean, it doesn't matter because I've been 4 years. I waited 4 years.
Did it produce any fruit in those four years?
Very much so. Uh-huh. Very much so. But we waited the 4 years. So, but now that tree also has other branches that voluntarily on its own. I didn't put any concrete or anything to make it touch the ground, but now some of the other branches have touched the ground and have rooted. What's the status of that?
Yeah, so that's not an issue because it's still connected to the original tree and it grows into the ground. That's fine.
But it's a separate
system. That's okay. That's okay. That's okay. The issue is going to be when you detach it from the original tree, what would be the law? I have to brush up on it myself. I don't know the answer to the question. I suspect that that's okay. Your original question, though, is then it was taken out of the ground and put someplace else. That's where you get into the real issue.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do very well when the third temple is built because I'm a graduate horticulturist.
Uh-huh.
And that'll be my specialty. I was looking for a job.
I
don't see any landscaping around the temple. So now I got a job.
You're not allowed to grow a tree. Not allowed to grow a tree on the Temple Mount. You have to install the job. Good. Okay. Perfect. Yes.
I'm sorry. I must have missed something. So I didn't understand. First, I heard that you have to, in the fourth year, you have to take that money and spend it in Yerushalayim.
Mm-hmm.
The sanctity of fruit has gone to that money. And then I heard you just say that in the fourth year, the fruit that coin has to be thrown.
Today, when there's no Beis HaMikdash.
The other one was the Beis HaMikdash. And so today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So today in the fourth year. Now, so I thought that you have to wait 4 years before you eat the fruit. You're saying at the beginning of the fourth year, you can eat the fruit.
In Yerushalayim or exchange it for money.
So in Yerushalayim, you can eat it without exchanging it for money.
Correct.
But here, you have to
exchange it for
exchange
money.
Exchange it.
But only the fourth year. The first 3 years, it's off limits.
Yeah, yeah. So I waited a full 4 years, and then I ate it in the fifth year, but I didn't do anything with money or anything.
Well, the fifth year is fine.
It's only in that beginning of the fourth year.
Yeah, but it has to be fruits that grow in the fifth year. Fruits that grow in the fourth year or still have the law of the fourth year. It's not when you eat it, it's when it grows.
Okay, so
that matters.
So I ate fruit in the fifth year.
So it depends when the fruits grew.
When you say when they first budded and before
okay,
they
we're
gonna got
talk
ripe?
About we're gonna talk about that right now. Okay. So how do we count these years? That's the question. How do these years get counted? Now everybody knows that there's a date on the calendar called Tu Bishvat. There's a date called Tu Bishvat. So tonight, we're actually going to understand what that date is all about, because nobody understands what Tu Bishvat is all about. Everybody says it's the Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah says it's the Rosh Hashanah for the trees. What on earth does that mean? Now, you're going to hear tonight that it is actually fairly technical, and it is not romantic at all, as you'll hear, and it's not so simple. It doesn't stand alone. It actually has to do with Rosh Hashanah as well, the real Rosh Hashanah as well. So you're going to hear that tonight. So this is going to be so that you can really understand how it works with Tu Bishvat. Now we're going to... Somebody put this on the board and left it up here. I don't understand.
For like 3 weeks.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah, but aren't we going to need it on Wednesday night?
I'll have to rewrite it.
Okay.
Whoever put it up, I'll have to rewrite it.
Okay.
Okay.
Left
fine.
That maybe.
Okay. I don't know if these all work. Let's try. Try green. Okay. Okay. Here we go. So we have you plant the fruit. You plant the tree. Okay, so let's say you plant the tree. Let's say when, Bert, when's the best time to plant the tree in Atlanta?
In Atlanta?
Hmm?
In the fall.
In the fall.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's give me a good secular date to plant the tree.
October 1st.
Okay, let's assume that Rosh Hashanah. This is year one. Year number one. So Rosh Hashanah let's assume that year Rosh Hashanah is when was it this year?
September 21st.
I think 21st. Okay? September 21st. Planting October 1st. Okay. So what's that?
So it's probably Socus we probably could.
Okay, so, oh, you think so?
No.
I think it might be.
No, it's Yom Kippur.
It's Yom Kippur, isn't it?
No, Yom Kippur was the 30th. It was the 30th of September. Wasn't it?
I don't remember.
10 days after the 21st.
Let's do this right. We don't want anybody's going to come and see it on the board. They're going to think that we're, like, you know.
No, it was not October 1st, Yom
Kippur. Was it September 30th? September 30th,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It was the 30th. Yeah.
No, so actually, October 1st is perfect. Day after Yom Kippur. Day after Yom Kippur, you say, I'm not putting up a sukkah. I'm going to go plant trees. Okay, fine. Year two. When is year two? Year two is Rosh Hashanah. That is year two, which next week, year, I believe, is September 10th. Okay? When is year three? When does year three, year two begins on Rosh Hashanah? Year three begins on Rosh Hashanah.
Probably October something.
I think it is actually, it's October something. Okay, we'll put a question mark here. And whenever, Rosh, that's the beginning of year three. So when is the beginning of year four? Year four begins Rosh Hashanah. That is year four. that's fine. So what does Tu'ish Rod have to do with anything? Okay, so here's the point. Now, you know what? I'm going to actually erase year 4. We're going to go back to year 3 for a minute. Do I want to erase year 4? One second. No. Let's keep it like this. Okay. So year 4 begins on Rosh Hashanah. So the actual tree is a little less than 3 years old because it was planted a few days after Rosh Hashanah year 1. Nevertheless, its birthday is Rosh Hashanah of year 2. Its next birthday is Rosh Hashanah of year 3. And its next birthday is Rosh Hashanah of year 4. So now it's considered to be a 3-year-old tree. It's now into its 4th year. And now you can talk about taking it to Yerushalayim or exchanging it for money, etc. Okay. However, now is when Tu B'Shvat plays a role. Once you get to year 4 and year 5, that's where Tu B'Shvat is going to play a role. How will Tu B'Shvat play a role? So, like this. If a fruit, let's say, okay, we're going to need some technical terms over here. You have a fruit tree. So what's the first thing that you see that is eventually going to turn into a fruit?
A bud.
A bud. Okay. Flower. And then a flower. And then after the bud?
It starts to form the fruit.
Okay. So there is... There is some we'll call it first.
Would it be a bud and then a flower and then the
fruit? Right.
Okay. Yeah.
First buds.
Yeah. We'll call it first buds. Mm-hmm. Well, say that the first buds happen, let's say in November.
No, it's too bad time.
Too early?
Yeah.
When are the first buds going to happen?
March.
Huh?
January.
Okay, let's call it January. Okay? January. Then comes Tu B'Shvat. Okay, whenever that is. And then comes second buds. Okay, we'll say that that happens in March. Okay. The first buds, even though they happen after Rosh Hashanah, but since they come before Tu B'Shvat, they are considered to be still within the 3rd year. They are not yet 4th year fruits. The buds that come after Tu B'Shvat of the 4th year are now 4th year fruits. In other words, you need 2 things to happen. You have to get to the 4th year, and then you also need Tu B'Shvat. That's what you need in order for the buds to be considered the 4th year and not the 3rd year. So, when we say that Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah, it's the beginning of the year for fruits, it's only half the story. Yet count the years based on Rosh Hashanah like we always count Rosh Hashanah. Always, for everything. However, when you get to the 4th year, Tu B'Shvat will play a role determining which buds that come before Tu B'Shvat are considered to be from the previous year, and the ones that come after Tu B'Shvat are for the next year. That's what Tu B'Shvat is about. The Hebrew word is chanata. That's the word, the Hebrew word for the budding of the fruit. And that will be relevant over here. So, you could argue, well, then why do we deal with Rosh Hashanah? Why don't you deal with Tu B'Shvat? Why do we mention, just say, Tu B'Shvat is really the 4th Tu B'Shvat? Because if you think about it, if it was planted in October, well, it went through a Tu B'Shvat here. That's Tu B'Shvat number 1. Then it went through a Tu B'Shvat here. That's Tu B'Shvat number 2. It went through Tu B'Shvat here. That's Tu B'Shvat number 3. So, there's the 4th Tu B'Shvat. So, ignore Rosh Hashanah. The answer is, what if you didn't plant on October 1st? What if you planted on June 1st? Now, if you planted on June 1st, that's well after the first Tu B'Shvat of that year. So if you counted Tu B'Shvat as the only thing that mattered, when you got to here, it's not yet the 4th Tu B'Shvat. It's only 3 Tu B'Shvats, right? But because we don't deal with Tu B'Shvat until you get to the 4th year, this is the fourth year because even though you planted on June 1st and it's only a few months till Rosh Hashanah, it turns 2 years old on Rosh Hashanah. And it turns 3 years old the next Rosh Hashanah. And it turns 4 years old the next Rosh Hashanah, but now you got to deal with the budding of the fruits to decide whether it's in the third year or the fourth year. That's how Tu B'Shvat works. So it's technical. It's not a simple thing. We teach the kids, you know, about the fruits and we sing songs and all that. It's really a very technical rule. And as I said, there's nothing romantic about it. It's a very technical rule having to do with once you get to the fourth Rosh Hashanah in the fruit's lifetime, in the tree's lifetime, then you decide whether the upcoming fruits are considered to be third-year fruits or fourth-year fruits based on Tu B'Shvat. The same thing happens the following year, which I'm not going to put on the board because we're out of space, but in year five, the same thing happens because you also have to know whether it's a year four fruit or a year five fruit because the difference between a year three fruit and a year four fruit is whether it's prohibited or whether you need to take it to Yerushalayim or exchange it for money. The difference between a year four fruit and a year five fruit is a year five fruit doesn't have to do anything, just eat it. So in the fifth year, the same thing happens. You get to the fifth Rosh Hashanah, and then whenever buds before Tu B'Shvat is considered a fourth year fruit, whenever buds after Tu B'Shvat is considered a fifth year fruit. And that's the way Tu B'Shvat works in tandem with Rosh Hashanah. Yeah.
So do you have, I mean, how do you distinguish them, and can you pull those first buds off that are before Tu B'Shvat so that you don't
okay, so that's a good question. Meaning, can you just destroy them? Just take them off? Yeah. So I believe you can. I don't think there's an issue with that. I don't know what that does to the growing of the tree. That bird can answer better than I can. What would that hurt the tree if you started ripping off all the buds?
No.
It wouldn't hurt it.
Just leave them alone.
But you have to distinguish which are first and which are second.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, do you go around marking?
You have to mark them all with a red string.
Yeah, you have to know what's what. That is correct. You'd have to know what's what. Yeah.
If you pull them all off, you don't have to mark anything.
Just wait them.
Yeah, but if you
have
but
to
if
take
wait.
Those, you have to.
Except,
oh yeah,
some of them get destroyed and some of them get
branch into this, but
exchanged.
No pun intended. Or pun intended.
Pun intended.
Okay.
But if a tree buds in January, it's not going to bud in March.
Right.
Okay.
It's the one time.
Right.
One time.
But you'll have, what if it buds like right around Tu B'Shvat? So you'll have some that bud right before and right after. Right. Yeah, I understand. Right.
Okay.
Most trees are not going to have a dual budding season. Right. Right. The Gemara speaks about one type of tree that does have a double budding season.
Trees that will fruit twice.
Right. Right. But yeah.
Not normal.
Right.
Not
but if it is in fact around, you know, February, March time, then you're going to be right around Tu B'Shvat, and some will actually be before and some afterwards.
Right.
And that, you know, that's where it'll be relevant.
It depends where you are.
And it depends where you are, right, right. In Atlanta, the season is a little shorter.
Yeah,
the winter is a little shorter, so the growing season is longer. Right. So that's what's going to happen. So that is the way it works. And the truth is that typically Tu B'Shvat is not a time of the year where you see a whole bunch of activity going on. What's really happening on Tu B'Shvat, the Gemara says, is the sap rises in the trees. But that's something that's happening subtly. It's not really this, you know, this flowering. It's not the springtime yet. That's a little later where you get this gorgeous flowering time of the year. So it's a more subtle thing, Tu B'Shvat. So this is the way it works. There are a few more details depending on what the proximity is to Rosh Hashanah that you planted. I'm not going into that level of detail in this discussion, but you get the idea over here. So so if a person plants not from a seed, but actually plants a branch or a sapling in their yard, and it doesn't come with soil, then one does need to be careful to note when they did this so that they will be aware of the laws of Arla as they approach. Now, there are also discussions in Shulchan Aruch, what if you aren't sure? What if it's a doubt? I don't know when it budded, or I'm not, you know, it's not clear. So those all have, it's all there in the Shulchan Aruch. Again, I would have to brush up more to answer questions specifically. And anyway, that level of detail we don't need to get into now, but there are rules about it. And a person, of course, when they have a question, should ask their LOR, their local Orthodox rabbi.
Sometimes all the buds freeze.
Okay, and then
there's no fruit
that year. Right. Yeah, so that would happen too. Okay. Fine. Now, the Torah says in Pasuk Chaf Hey, verse 25, it says, in the fifth year, you'll eat all its fruits, to add, lahosif lachem tevuaso, to add for you its crop. We have a special bracha that is mentioned here in the Torah, that one who keeps the laws of Arla will merit to have a good crop. Because one would might have argued, here the Torah is saying the first 3 years I can't eat the fruits at all, and the fourth year I have to go through this whole trouble with money or Yerushalayim or whatever it is, so I'm going to lose a whole bunch of money. This is a bad proposition. The Torah says, no, if you keep the laws of Arla, you will merit a good crop. It's similar to what we find with Shemitah, that the Torah guarantees that if we keep Shemitah properly, that we will get a bumper crop. Here too, the Torah is telling us, don't fret it. You're not the ones, we're not the ones who made up these rules. Hashem made up the rules, and Hashem is the one who decides whether it's going to be a good crop or, God forbid, not. And he tells us that if we keep the rules, then the crop will be a good crop. Pasuk Chaf Vav, 26. Lo sochlu al hadam, do not eat on the blood. Lo senachashu, velo seonenu, do not be superstitious, and do not, it's two different words for superstitious. The way that they translate it is, don't indulge in sorcery, and don't believe in lucky times. Okay, we'll deal with those two things separately. Let's first deal with the first phrase of lo sochlu al hadam, do not eat on the blood. That's very ambiguous. What does that mean? Don't eat on the blood. The Gemara in Sanhedrin gives us no fewer than five explanations for what this means. They are all correct. It's not a dispute. The Torah is saying five different prohibitions in this phrase, lo sochlu al hadam, do not eat on the blood. I will read to you the five rules that are being brought out from this one phrase. First of all, the Gemara says, this is a prohibition against eating a limb of an animal that was severed from the animal prior to the death of the animal. Don't eat al hadam, on the blood. Blood is often synonymous with life. Blood is considered to be the life of a person, the soul of a person and of an animal. And if one eats al hadam, on the blood, what that means is to eat a limb while the animal is still alive. So here you have the prohibition against doing that. Okay? That's number one. Number two. Don't eat meat, a carbon. Don't eat from a sacrifice of the Beis HaMikdash until the blood is thrown on the altar. You know the process. We've talked about this extensively. The animal is slaughtered. The blood is caught. The blood is then taken to the altar and thrown on the altar, depending on the type of animal, how much blood has to be put on the altar, where it has to be put on the altar, etc. Many, many details about that. We've learned that before. Then what happens to the rest of the animal? Some parts of the animal are burned on the altar. Other parts are eaten by the Kohen or by the people who are bringing the carbon. Well, what if the blood was not thrown on the altar? The blood was caught in a receptacle and was placed down and not thrown on the altar. Meanwhile, the rest of the animal is processed and now the meat is ready to be eaten. One is not allowed to eat that meat until the blood gets thrown on the altar. Lo sochlu al adam, do not eat on the blood, meaning that the throwing of the blood on the altar has to precede the eating of the carbon. That is number two. Number three, the Gemara tells us, you know that the rule is that if a person, God forbid, loses a relative, then the law is that there's something called a sudas havara, that the first meal that the mourners eat following the funeral is called the sudas havara, the meal of havara. The sudas havara, that meal has some specific rules. One of the rules is that the mourner is not allowed to eat their own food. It has to be food that is provided for the mourner by others, by relatives, by friends, by neighbors. That's where the minhag comes from, to send food to a shiva home. Why do people send food to a shiva home? So obviously people are sending shiva, they're not able to run a home properly. But the real source for that is because the first meal that is eaten after the burial is required to be provided by the neighbors and not for a person to eat their own food. So that prohibition comes from here. Lo sochlu al hadam, do not eat. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Wrong. So that's the rule. That doesn't come from here. That's the rule. Lo sochlu al hadam means that what if a person is, God forbid, executed by Beis Din? Person commits a sin for which the punishment is capital punishment, and the person is executed. What happens to their relatives? So here, Reuven is put to death by Beis Din. Reuven is buried. Now, what happens to his relatives? Do his relatives get a sudas havara? Are they required to have a meal given by the neighbors? And the answer is no. That there is no sudas havara for the relatives of those who are killed by Beis Din, those who are executed. It's not their fault, but the rule does not apply of sudas havara. And therefore, lo sochlu al adam, do not eat on the blood, don't eat a sudas havara, don't eat a meal that is provided by others, al adam, on blood, for a person who was executed by Beis Din. For that type of death, there is no law of sudas havara.
What about shiva?
That's a good question. The Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses the question of shiva. It seems that there is not a typical shiva, because the problem is that it might appear that the relatives are at odds with what Beis Din did, and that's inappropriate. The relatives need to affirm that Beis Din is correct and that the ruling stands.
What does havara mean?
That's a good question. I don't know the exact translation. I should. I did it one time. I do not know now.
So they're not allowed to eat a meal that was...
So that's what it seems like.
I mean, the way you worded it.
That's what it sounds like. I can read...
This says the Beis Din has to fast on the day it pronounces a death.
Oh, well, that's the next thing. We didn't get there yet. That's something else. Right.
You said they're not required.
Yeah. Rashi says we don't provide a meal.
Okay.
That's the way Rashi says it. Okay.
But it's not a halacha thing. That's suggested that you just...
Well, no. So it says it here. Now let her provide a meal for him. You don't provide a meal.
Well, I bet you could if you wanted to.
Evidently not.
No, that was my question.
Evidently not. No. We don't treat them as regular mourners. That's the point that's being said over here. The fourth thing, which is what Mrs. Kaiser just said, is that if Sanhedrin has to put somebody to death, if Beis Din has to put somebody to death, they do not eat anything all day. They fast. Beis Din, if they have to put somebody to death, they are required to fast the day of the execution, because they have to be focused only on what's going on, make sure they did not leave any stone unturned, make sure that they examined the case correctly, and that they are not involved in their own pursuits, like eating, but rather involved solely in the case at hand. Therefore, they're not allowed to eat on the day that someone is to be executed. And finally, we know that there's a law in the Torah called a ben sorer umore, which we'll get to, please God, at some point. A ben sorer umore is a boy that is a wayward son, and that wayward son is put to death. Now, there are many, many details about a ben sorer umore, about a wayward son. It is something which is extremely unlikely to happen because of all the details. In fact, the Gemara says it never did happen. And the Gemara says it never will happen. So we'll talk about that, please God, when we get to the discussion of ben sorer umore, which is in Parshas Ki Tsetse, which is in Sefer Devarim, which means we have a little while to go before we get there. But all the Torah describes over there is what happens if a boy, if he's 13 years old, and he behaves in this manner, the Torah describes what manner he behaves in, then this is what his parents should do, and eventually he's put to death. Where is the prohibition against the ben sorer umore, a boy who behaves in that way? Remember, the Torah always has a statement of consequence, but also a statement of prohibition. There's usually two different statements. One is the prohibition, thou shalt not, do not commit murder. Now, do not commit murder does not tell you what happens if the person does commit murder. It just says, don't do it. That's one. Then there is another statement in the Torah, if one shall murder, they should be put to death. Now, that doesn't say you shouldn't do it. That just says what happens if you do it. But what happens if you do it doesn't mean it's prohibited. Conceivably, the Torah could say, if you eat pork, you will get lashes. That doesn't mean it's prohibited to eat pork. Maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth it. So I'll have the pork and I'll get lashes. That doesn't mean it's prohibited. Just because the Torah says there's a punishment doesn't mean that it's prohibited. Maybe a person has the right to make a choice. That's what it costs. Just like you go to the store and there's a price tag, perhaps the price tag is lashes. So the Torah also has to say, do not eat pork. That's the prohibition. And then the Torah can say, and if you do, this is what happens. There's always an azhara, a prohibition, and an onesh, and a punishment. So in Parashas Kisetse, when the Torah discusses ben sorer umore, the wayward son, there's no prohibition over there. It just says what happens. This is what you should do to someone who behaves in this manner. But it doesn't say that you're not allowed to behave in that manner. Where is the prohibition? It is here. Do not eat al hadam, which, as Rashi explains, don't eat in a manner that will bring you to the death penalty. Because what the ben sora umore does, what does he do that's so bad that we put him to death? He steals money from his parents, from his father, and he uses the money to purchase a lot of wine and meat, and he eats like a glutton and drinks like a glutton. So that's an eating and a drinking that brings him to the death penalty. So lo sochu al adam, do not eat on blood, which means don't eat in a manner that will bring a person to the death penalty. Normally, eating doesn't bring a person to the death penalty. A person can eat and get punished, but not with death. There's a lot of things a person could eat and get punished for it, but it's not typically with the death penalty. This would be an eating that brings to the death penalty. So one should not do so. So again, we have five different prohibitions that are derived from here. Again, we'll run through them quickly. One is not to eat from an animal while the animal is still alive. Another is not to eat from a carbon, from a sacrifice, before the blood is thrown on the altar. A third one is not to provide a meal for the relatives of those who have been executed. Another is that the beis din that commits a person to death needs to fast the day of the execution. And finally, it's the prohibition against the ben sorer umora, the wayward son. The prohibition is derived from here that one is not allowed to behave in the manner that the wayward son behaves. Yeah.
I just glanced at the comments down here. It says the beis din must fast on the day it pronounces a death sentence.
Yes. Yeah. It pronounces the sentence.
And the rule is that the death sentence, the death has to occur that day.
Yes, we have a rule. We have a rule called inui hadin. We do not allow, we have no such thing as death row. Death row is a torture that is a terrible, terrible thing. Our rule is that once the death penalty is pronounced, the death is carried out the same day, immediately. Now, that's only once it's pronounced. Until it's pronounced, there can be all kinds of deliberation. Of course, we don't want them rushing into a ruling on a death penalty case. We want them to take their time and go through it carefully. But once it is decided this person has been put to death, it is done the same day. You don't let him sit there and think about it. He's put to death immediately. Now, the truth is, it doesn't work exactly like that, which means that typically with other types of court cases, if it's monetary or if it's corporal or whatever it is, so those, the beis din deliberates, then there's a vote, and then if the vote comes out that the person is liable, then the punishment or the ruling is carried out. With a death penalty case, a capital crime, so based in debates and back and forth, they vote. If the vote comes out in favor of execution, they do not conclude the case then. They don't hit the gavel. They deliberately adjourn, wait overnight, come back the next morning, and vote again. As we want the based in to toss and turn all night, thinking about it, so that the next day they can come back, and they have to really believe it the next day in order to execute it. That's not called inoy hadin. That's not called delaying the judgment, because there we haven't actually finished the judgment. There's a deliberate one-night delay in order that they think about it. And that night, the way it says it in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, is we adjourn the case and we encourage the members of the court to hold quiet discussion amongst themselves in twos and threes and deliberate it and debate it and let them hash it out in private. Let them go over it again. And they're not supposed to sleep well that night. They're not supposed to eat that evening too much. They're supposed to really think about it. The next day they come back in, and the stenographers have already recorded everybody's vote from the day before, and then they get up and they say, okay, so-and-so, yesterday you voted this way, what do you say today? And you let them, you know, we see whether they still maintain their position. If they do maintain their position, then we do put him to death that day. They do not eat that day. Yeah.
So what if the previous day they voted not to?
Then the case is closed. Then it's over. Once they're right, then it's done. They only have to think about it if it's in favor of execution. Right. Now the rest of that pasuk, just let's make sure we finish this off, in 26 was lo senachashu, which they translate as sorcery, and lo sonenu, which is believe in lucky times. Now, there are several different prohibitions, which we'll have a few of them here coming up, but there are several different prohibitions against various types of superstition, sorcery, black magic, things like that. There's all kinds of different ones. The Torah has several of them listed. These two, nichush, which is the first one, which they translate as sorcery, but is typically referred to as superstition. And the second one of lo se'onenu, and ona is a time, ayin vav nun hey, that is a time, so don't work with times. So that one is typically understood the way they translate it over here, which is not to believe in lucky times. What is superstition that is prohibited? What are we talking about over here? So a black cat crosses my path, and I believe that it's going to give me bad luck. That is a superstition. So a superstition is prohibited. However, what is prohibited about it? Is it simply believing it? What is the prohibition? Now, we know there are certain things you're not allowed to believe. You're not allowed to believe in other gods other than Hashem. Can't believe that. That is a prohibition against thinking. You're not allowed to believe, to believe with all your being, that there is another power other than Hashem, an independent power. We're not allowed to believe that. Here, if I believe that the black cat crossing my path will give me bad luck, I've not violated the law of superstition, of lo senachashu. The violation is only when I act upon it, which would mean if there is I have a very important business deal or business meeting. I have an interview with a potential client or with a potential employer, and it's something very important to me, or maybe an interview with someone who might purchase something, or might buy something very, very important. and it's scheduled for today. I come out of my house and a black cat crosses my path. I say, that's bad luck. I call up the person and I delay the interview till tomorrow. That is reacting to the superstition. That's where we get into the hot water. That's where you get into the problem. But simply walking around with a foreboding that this black cat crossed my path, oh no, what's going to happen to me? That's not violating the prohibition. It may be foolish, but it is not violating the prohibition of believing in superstition. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the poo-poo-poo. What is an ayin hara?
Okay, so an ayin hara is not that. An ayin hara is that if a person, God forbid, causes someone else to be jealous of them, then that can cause problems. Because what happens is, if I have a talent or I have something and I flaunt it, and that makes you jealous, so then upstairs they say, oh, you're showing off what you have. Let's examine and make sure you really deserve it. It opens the books. That's what it does.
Okay.
When one flaunts what they have, it opens the books upstairs.
I know people who... You don't ask how many children.
Right, for that reason. Because they don't want to say, because they don't want to make people jealous if they have a lot of children, Baruch Hashem, or they have a lot of health or money or whatever. They don't want to flaunt it.
Okay.
So they try to avoid those things. But that's where it comes from.
No, I don't know what poo poo poo.
No, it's nothing. It's nothing. That's it doesn't mean anything. It's just a way of when people say Bali ayin hara without the ibalah. What they're trying to say is, don't be jealous. Don't be jealous. Right? That's what it's saying. It's saying, listen, Hashem gave this.
I understand.
Right. Hashem gave this to me. I'm not trying to flaunt it. Please don't be jealous, because I don't want you to cause me harm. And we have to know that when we're jealous of others, it does cause harm or can cause harm. And that's what Bali ayin hara is saying. That please don't think in that way of what I have. I don't want to lose it. You wouldn't want me to lose it. So don't be jealous. That's what ayin hara is. But the prohibition here of believing in superstition or believing in lucky times, that, oh, when the, you know, when the moon is like this, or when the sun is like that, or when the stars, that's when I should do such and such. It's when I react to it that causes the problem. That's where there's a prohibition. But just to believe in it and not to react to it, that is not inherently prohibited.
Is it reacting to, like, have weddings on the fourth day?
On the what? The Mishnah says no, because the Mishnah has reasons for that. You mean on Wednesday?
But whenever it was good.
Yeah. No, but that wasn't because of a lucky. That wasn't. The Mishnah discusses a couple different things, but one is because of when Beis Din sat. That was important. The other thing is because on the day where it says pru or vu, so that's considered to be a good day to get married. So there, it's not believing in a time because of some made up thing. It's because the Torah gives a bracha of pru or vu, be fruitful and multiply on that day. So therefore, we presume that day has a special bracha attached to it.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.